This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, preventing the 99% from being thrown over the austerity cliff in the fiscal showdown.
And now we move to Michael Moore. Michael Moore recalling his film Bowling for Columbine while advocating for the release of Native American leader and artist Leonard Peltier, now falsely imprisoned for 37 years, and in the wake of the latest horrific gun violence, seeks to understand what he refers to as the DNA of violence rooted in American history. Michael Moore.
I am honored to be here tonight to lend my voice to President Obama. Do the right thing and let Leonard Peltier out of prison now, before the end of the year. If not you, President Obama, who? Who? It's got to be you. I followed this case for a very long time, and the idea of how we incarcerate people in this country, millions tonight sit in prison. And Leonard is there for a crime that he didn't commit and has served 37 years enslaved in a pen. What will history write about us and how we locked up some of our best people? There, but for the grace of God, will you or I when it comes to him. But there are so many others. I mean, this whole, the prison industrial complex that we have in this country. I just saw the movie of the Central Park Five. I had just moved to New York of the year of the trial. And if you remember, those of you who lived here then, all the newspapers and the media convicted these young men. They did such an incredible job of convincing the public. I remember listening to liberals in this city, and they bought it. And the silence of people who didn't speak out, I think, especially if you watch this film, it makes everyone complicit in the fact that these young men served so many years in prison for a crime that they did not commit. And you see these stories all the time. On 60 Minutes last week, a couple of dozen people in Illinois that they've gotten out of prison, many of them, some of them off death row. Right? We hear these stories now all the time of people who have been incarcerated for 20, 30, 15 years, and then they're let out because they realize, well, they didn't commit the crime. I decided some time ago that from now on, whenever I hear the police or the FBI or whoever present a case, I start with the assumption that they're lying. And they may not be, but it's up to them to convince me that they're not a liar. I got to meet I.F. Stone before he died. And there's a baby boomers applauding. But for the youngsters in here, he was a great journalist, and he didn't work for the man. He put out his own little newsletter every week or every other week called I.F. Stone's Weekly. And one of his famous things that was on his masthead that I remember, or one of his slogans or whatever, was, "All governments and corporations are run by liars, and nothing they say should be believed." That was the engine of what he believed as a journalist. He started with that assumption. You have to prove that you're not. Incarcerating Leonard Peltier for 37 years is an act of violence. We are a violent country. I'm not just talking about gun deaths and all that. You know, we were a country that was founded in genocide. So right there, our original sin is murder and killing and violence to achieve our ends. And then we were built on the backs of slaves. That's our legacy. Founded in genocide, built on the backs of slaves. Crazy man went to an elementary school and attacked 22 children in China a few hours before Connecticut. An elementary school was attacked in China by an insane man, and 22 children were his victims. But all he had was a knife. Total number of dead in the Chinese elementary school? Zero. I hope you don't mind, but I'd like to just say a few words about what happened, because I've been concerned about this issue for a long time. Yes, we need more gun control. Yes, we need free mental health services in this country. But I really believe that even if we had better gun control laws and better mental health, that we would still be the sort of sick and twisted, violent people that we've been for hundreds of years. That is something that's just in our craw, just in our DNA. And to get that out of our DNA is going to take a lot more than passing a bill in Albany or D.C. That's not going to do it. And you know, other countries, I mean, they have their crazy people, and they have people like they've been shootings and killings in Norway and France and in Germany. But there haven't been 61 mass killings like there have been in this country just since Columbine. 61 mass shootings in this country. I like to say that I sort of agree with the NRA when they say guns don't kill people, people kill people, except I would just modify that a bit to say guns don't kill people, Americans kill people. Because that's what we do. We invade countries, we send drones in to kill civilians. We've got 5 wars going on right now where our soldiers are killing people, like 5 that we know of. We are on the short list of illustrious countries who have the death penalty. We believe it's okay to kill you when you've committed a crime. And then we have all the other forms of violence in this country that we don't really call violence, but they are acts of violence. When you make sure that 50 million people don't have health insurance in your country, and that according to the congressional study that was done, 44,000 people a year die in America for the simple reason that they don't have health insurance, that's a form of murder. That murder is being committed by the insurance companies. When you evict millions of people from their homes, that's an act of violence. That's called a home invasion. And not one of them has gone to prison for what they've done. When you've eliminated so many millions of jobs, when you've ruined communities like mine in Flint, Michigan, you have killed people. Because having seen firsthand the effects of these corporate decisions, the alcoholism, the drug abuse, divorce, suicide, all the social problems that go along with this act of violence, but we don't call it violence, and no one's ever arrested for it. I think it's a real shame, and frankly, as an American, this is not how I want to be remembered. And so I think that we have a much larger job. We have to get Leonard out of prison immediately. We have to. I ask you to support the Innocence Project and the other projects at Northwestern University and others who are trying to get people out of prison who shouldn't be there. We need to reform our drug laws and stop this phony war on drugs and locking people up, using drugs as an excuse to commit the racist act of locking up so many African-American and Hispanic men and women. I was watching Amy's show, listening to it yesterday. See that? I just have to say your first name. You're a rock star. And she ran a videotape of Leonard in prison reciting some of his poetry. If you have a chance, you can go on the Democracy Now! Website and watch it. It's a very moving poetry, and it breaks your heart to think about why he's not on the stage tonight, why he's still there. But anyway, so today I woke up and I I was inspired by his poetry, so I decided to write a poem for him. And I will read it to you first, and then I will somehow I'll get him on the phone and read it to him myself. So here goes. Dear Mr. President, please let Leonard come home. Let him be home for Christmas. That would make my Yuletide gay. Let his troubles be far, far away. He's been gone some 37 years. Just think of what he's missed. I want to take him to IKEA and see if he can figure out how to put a coffee table and matching bookcase together. I want to take him to Starbucks and show him the difference between a grande and a venti. I'd like to bring him to my home and sit with him and watch The Bachelorette and see if he can guess who will get the single red rose. I want to ride the 7 train with him and go to Citi Field, named after a bank that fleeced millions of people. I want to show him all of this. 20 women now in the U.S. Senate. An African-American in the White House. And no soda over 12 ounces in New York City. And maybe, just maybe, he can help us with the next Occupy, the next battle, to stand with the millions who are in need of a courageous leader, now more than ever. Please, Mr. President, let Leonard Peltier come home, or we shall all bury our hearts at Wounded Knee. Thank you very much.
And you are listening to Michael Moore as he spoke at a benefit to bring Leonard Peltier home and about the culture of violence rooted in American history. Now, with politicians demanding cuts in public benefits, Robert Borsage counsels against buying into the fiscal cliff fraud. Borsage says the problem is not deficits, it's the lack of a foundation for sustainable growth that includes working people. Without a political movement to achieve the latter, very little progress will be made on the former.
Borsage maintains we must counter the spin and show how we can turn the conversation about debt and deficits to what really matters, putting people back to work, protecting the economically vulnerable, and ending giveaways to the wealthy. With us is Robert Borsage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future.
Well, I'm exasperated because, unfortunately, so much of the public has bought into the hysteria that we've been fed. There wasn't a day that went by before this tragic shooting in Connecticut that we were not, in terms of media, pushed over the cliff, that we were going to self-destruct as a country unless there was austerity measures taken. What is the real skinny on the, quote, the fiscal cliff, if you will?
The real skinny on the fiscal cliff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a cliff. It's not something that lives in nature. This is a totally Washington-created moment where they've agreed in the last debt limit negotiation that if nothing is done, they will cut domestic and military spending by about 9% a year, and they will allow the Bush tax cuts to expire and not continue the unemployment insurance and payroll taxes, which have helped sustain the economy. It's not a cliff also because you don't fall off it. These changes would take, would kick in, the effects of the changes would kick in over time. The hysteria about it is very interesting because the very people who are saying this is going to drive us into a recession, which I agree it will over time, over the course of the year, drive us into a recession, are the very same people who are saying, so in order to avoid it, we ought to exact longer-term cuts and some kind of austerity on the economy, which in itself could drive us into a recession. And this entire discussion, what's irritating about the entire discussion is that it simply ignores the real challenges the country faces. We have mass unemployment. We have over 20 million people in need of full-time work. By focusing on what level of austerity, how much deficit reduction we're going to do, we are ignoring the fundamental human problem, which is mass unemployment, and with mass unemployment, falling wages for most workers. And to deal with that, you've got to have a very different set of policies to make this economy work for working people, because it wasn't working for most Americans before the Great Recession. This is the first time under Bush when we've actually had a supposed recovery when middle-class households lost ground. Their median income actually declined while the economy was supposedly recovering. And today, as we speak, corporate profits are at the highest level of the economy in history, and workers' wages are at the lowest level as a percentage of the GDP in history. And we've got to deal with those. If you want to fix the deficit, you've got to fix the economy first so that it works for working people. Otherwise, we're going to do to ourselves what the Europeans have already done to themselves, which is drive ourselves back into a recession, or at least into slow growth that condemns tens of millions of Americans to declining wages and to unemployment.
So when you're saying, well, first of all, what I interpret you're saying is that if we do the cuts, it's just going to be self-inflicting, that if you're going to make more cuts because you're dragging the economy down and the deficit will be worse. So what's the alternative? What should you be doing right now?
Well, I personally agree that you've both got to do things to create jobs in the short term, and you've got to make investments that make our economy work better and better for most people in the longer term. So, for example, we have a totally outmoded and decrepit and increasingly dangerous infrastructure. We can borrow money at virtually 0%. We have a construction industry that's flat on its back. It is simply criminally stupid that we're not borrowing more money to invest in rebuilding an infrastructure that we have to rebuild and modernize anyway at this moment. This is like a historic opportunity that would put people to work, but it would also make modernization and investments that would make our economy more competitive in the long term. Similarly, we've spent the Great Recession laying off hundreds of thousands of teachers, cutting advanced placement courses, cutting after-school programs, cutting preschool, pre-K programs, which we know are the most effective investments you can make. Again, we ought to be putting people to work, making those investments, tax the wealthiest Americans to help pay for them, or corporations that are sitting on trillions of dollars of profits and not investing them, and use that money to put people to work in areas that will help educate the next generation and make America, again, a much more competitive place in the future. Similarly, you can't continue to create an economy that works if 1% of the population is capturing 93% of the income growth. So we ought to be raising the minimum wage. We ought to be helping workers, empowering workers to organize. And we ought to be raising taxes on the rich without inflicting cuts on Medicare and Social Security recipients in order to help rebalance the economy and create the effective demand that any capitalist economy needs to work.
Robert, flesh out for, by the way, I got to put in my bid there for public housing, talking about the increase in homelessness pursuant to Sandy, not to mention the fact there were at least 54,000 homeless families that were stuffing our shelters before that. Hey, how about instead of talking about cuts to HUD, actually let's get that money out there. You want some real shovel-ready jobs? Yes, housing in the public domain. But aside from my own...
and similarly, allowing underwater homeowners to refinance.
Absolutely.
And cut the military budget.
But as we talk about that, help flesh out the politics of Obama with great aspirations towards, supreme commander, if you will, during earlier years. He is a lame duck president at this juncture, one would hope and say, okay, you got it now. You were reelected. You don't have to succumb to the pressures of Wall Street and the more reactionary sectors of, the plutocracy. What in hell's name do we not understand, or should we understand, about why the administration would take such retrograde, such reactionary, indeed, stance?
Well, what's interesting about Obama since he's been reelected, as we've gone into this fiscal showdown, is that he's been much stronger than critics like myself had expected. That is, he's hung tough on allowing the top-end Bush tax cuts to expire and has made it clear to Republicans that he's prepared to let all the tax cuts expire if they're not going to raise taxes on the rich. And he has thus far not accepted deals on that would tie that to cutting Social Security and Medicare. And most Democratic senators have said, look, Social Security is off the table. We're not going to raise the eligibility age for Medicare. That's off the table. There are reforms we can make in Medicare if you'd like having drug companies be forced to pay to get to negotiate with Medicare for bulk discounts on prescription drugs, which all of us would support. So thus far, the president's hung tough, but it seemed that that Boehner's concessions began to suggest, the White House started to suggest that it may well be headed towards an agreement that linked the hike in tax rates at the top end with cuts in Social Security that would otherwise be unacceptable. And I think if he goes there, this goes back to where the president was a little bit over a year ago when he was negotiating with Boehner on the debt ceiling. And there it was very clear, it seems, that he thought of part of his legacy was to be the liberal Democrat who cut back on our basic security pillars of the Great Society and the New Deal, Social Security and Medicare, and that he was prepared to show his courage in going after his base and the legacy of the party in doing that. Now, personally, I don't find it courageous to go after the most vulnerable population in the country. I find it bizarre that you would link that to fairer taxes on the wealthy. But I think if the president heads this way, it's not going to be out of political pressure so much, because both a majority of the population, majority of Republicans are against cutting Social Security and Medicare. It is going to be more a kind of his view of his legacy statement, which I think is truly wrongheaded.
Will he have a fight within the Democratic Party on this? Can they get this past Congress?
I think there will be a surprising fight in the Democratic Party. There's a lot of senators. I mean, in the House, Democrats are a minority, and so it's not clear Boehner can produce the right wing of the Republican Party for tax hikes of any kind. But if it passes the House, a lot of Democrats in the Senate have been very clear that Social Security should not be on the table, and that they are not in favor of the reactionary reform of lifting the eligibility age of Medicare. And so led by Senator Sanders and Sherrod Brown and others, remember, this is the lame duck Congress, so we won't have Elizabeth Warren there to help lead the fight. But led by them, Senator Merkley and others, I think you're going to see a bigger fight within the Democratic Party about this if the president goes down this line.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I encourage people to go to the website of Campaign for America's Future. There's a lot of material there, critical things, so we are not pushed over the cliff of austerity. Robert Borisage, thank you very much for joining us and for the work that you do.
My pleasure. Take care now.
And everybody should call their congressperson right away and yell and scream. They should tell them no cuts and tax the rich much more than Obama's willing to do.
Absolutely. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.